The following is a production of JSC Media. Stay ready.
You're listening to the People's Podcast.
I was honest. Was I brutally honest? Yes. But I think that that's the problem. Everybody's so scared to be honest with one another.
This is JSC Radio.
It wasn't good because, you know, it comes to a point where, like, your work cell phone, it had all these pictures and it was like everyone's dead, you know, because of the pictures that you've gotten from family.
Oh, right? Boy.
So you like go through and it's like, oh, all these people have passed away. But a lot of times, like, it was like the moms who would agree to talk, not the dads so much would agree to talk to us. It was oftentimes the moms. And a lot of the moms were my age, you know? And so a lot of the questions for me is how am I having such a different human experience than them? What is it with our society and our system to where, you know, certain communities are experiencing this disproportionately? Like, who can change this? Like, those are the questions I have.
You're listening to the People's Podcast. This is Jay. SC Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages. Hey now, how's it going? My name is J. Scott Smith, and this is the 119th episode of the People's Podcast. This is J. Scott Confidential, but you may also know it as JSC Radio. How's it going, y'all? Told you I was going to be giving you all these monthly, and this is the September edition of the People's Podcast. And normally I would go through some long spiel, or I would go through a monologue or things of that nature. And you know what? We're going to do things a little differently because for the first time since 2020, we have ourselves a guest. And let's just keep it a buck. We're going to go right into that guest right now. But first, I want to thank each and every one of you for checking out the return episode of the pod from last month, episode 118, our first one since 2020. Thank you so much for checking us out on all your favorite podcast providers. Of course, we're talking about Apple Podcasts, formerly known as iTunes, along with SoundCloud and Spotify and Pandora, as well as iHeartRadio, the Odyssey app, or wherever you happen to find your podcasts. Thank you. Damn it. Thank you. Of course, you can follow me, J. Scott Smith, on the Twitter machine, because that's what it's called, Twitter, at J. Scott Smith. Of course, I'm on Instagram at Real J. Scott Smith. Also, as well as on both Twitter and Instagram at JSC Radio. And yes, I am also on TikTok. You can find me there at Real J. Scott Smith. So let's just cut right to it. We got ourselves a guest, and it's a really good friend of mine. Her name is Andrea Klein Thomas. Now, she's the founder and chief creative officer of her own company, Mountain Court Media. They leverage Andrea's more than 15 years of experience in local news, and that includes stints in New York City, Charlotte, North Carolina, Nashville, Tennessee, and of course, where I met her through her time here in the city of Philadelphia. Now, Andrea also hosts her own podcast, The Next Best Thing, and she joins us on this episode to talk about not just her company and not just her podcast, but also talk to us about her path to get where she is. She's an amazing human being, very driven. She's one of the best people I know, and she's looked out for me a time or two as well. I'll bring that up a little bit later on here in the podcast. But you know what? Let's just cut it and get right to it. It's time for the 119th episode of the People's Podcast, and we get going from New York City with Andrea Klein Thomas. Let's get down to business, y'all.
You're listening to the People's Podcast. This is JSC Radio.
Andrea, I'm sitting here in New York City talking to you.
I've been able to. Thank you for coming all the way this way.
You're absolutely worth the trip up here. It's lovely to get here. So I met you in Philly a few years ago, and you were one of the first people I met, like when I got into Philly and actually started working, and you were always really great to me. And for one, I've always appreciated that. And your story since you left Philadelphia, I guess to start, What first got you interested in being a journalist? Because we all have that path. I get asked that a lot. But like, right. what was your story on how first getting you into wanting to actually go into this ridiculous business of journalism that we were in?
I know. When I got bit by the bug, I was 17 and I did a high school program in the summer for, it was at the American University. And it was a program for high school students, and they taught us how to use a camera, and we toured the NBC station in DC, WRC, and taught us how to track, like put our voice on stories and edit. And it was the first time I did really well in school, but I did not like school, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And that was the first time that I was just like, oh, wow. Because they set us loose on the National Mall. The Smithsonian has a Folklife Festival, and it will be like two countries and a state. They have nothing to do with each other. And I just remember that year, I think it was like South Africa, Oman, and a state or whatever. And I just had a camera, and people would talk to me. I would be like, hey, can you? Like, I was so shy. Like, oh my God, can you talk to me? And they were like, yes, I will. And I was just like, wow, they're just talking to me because I have a camera. Like, this isn't going to go anywhere. This is just for the parent showcase. And that was the first time when I was just like, everything that I like to do all in one role. And that's when I got bit by the bug.
Now, you started off and you knew you wanted to be a broadcaster. Was that the thing? Or did you start off writing, kind of ease into it?
No. It was always television. That was always like the pervasive medium that I consumed. And that was like, my parents always watched the news at night. And I had been to a station when I was in the seventh grade with my like church youth group, but I never put two and two together like I could do this. It was just like a fun thing to do because the youth group leader worked at the NBC station again. So I first wanted to be an editor because I liked the crafting of the stories. Mm-hmm. But my partner in that program, I didn't like the way she was like putting her voice on the story. And I'm like, no, say it this way. Like, she just didn't have the fire and desire that I had. And so I really was just like, oh, to have more control over how the story turns out, I need to get over myself and put my face on screen. So that's the only reason why I was on air. Other than that, I would have been behind the scenes.
Now, you grew up DC area.
Yeah.
Now, I always see DMV. Which of those were you in, the D, the M, or the V?
The M.
You were in the M, so yeah. Maryland. Okay.
In Maryland, yeah.
And you grew up watching DC, because your story sounds already a whole lot like mine. Yeah. I grew up in Detroit, same thing. It's like I was into a lot of the Detroit TV, Detroit radio. That just had an allure for me.
Right.
Give us a little bit of an idea of the path you took. So you've gone through high school, you get to college. What was that first experience as an actual professional like? Because we all got to start somewhere.
Well, I didn't have a professional experience until like way later. I mean, in terms of like, I had internships and stuff like that. So like, I'm a resourceful person. So I went to Boston College. They had a communications degree, but not journalism. I didn't know what I needed. I didn't know to look for a station on camp. You know what I mean? I didn't know, like, those were probably better options for me in my career trajectory. So I did generic communications, but I kept on telling all the professors, like, no, I want to do news. And there weren't very many news offerings. I took all of them. But like, I went to a conference by myself. I would go to Emerson, and at the conference met a professor at Emerson College. And she was like, oh, you should come over to Emerson. So I would go to Emerson. I'd help them write for their show. I anchored a show like at Emerson College. I took a class at Boston University because they had a studio, you know, stuff like that, because we didn't have one at BC. So, and then I had internships. I had a PR internship after my freshman year, and I was like, I don't want to do PR. And then after my sophomore, junior, and senior year, I had sophomore and junior summer, I had internships. Senior year, during the year, I had an internship. So I was always in the professional environment. But I couldn't get a job after. I didn't really have a tape. It was like not good. And I kept on sending it out, but nobody wanted to hire me.
Been there before. I've, I've definitely been there.
Not even behind the scenes, not even at the public access station.
Not like, getting, just not a sniff of anything.
Nobody, no callbacks, no, we got it, no.
Just nothing.
Just nothing.
It's thrown into the ether. So when, what was the first place to finally take the shot on you?
It ended up being Macon, Georgia, but I went to grad school. And so I went to University of Maryland for the grad school, and then they had all the things, right? And so I was like more than prepared. I already knew how to do some things just through my internships and stuff, but they had all the things. And so my first job in the business was in Macon, Georgia.
How was that experience for you in Macon?
Well, it was different. It was different. It was boot camp. I mean, I was making $18,000 a year. It was hard. And it was a culture shock. But days like now, like, I really appreciate that because it made me a self-sufficient reporter in terms of I was shooting, writing, and editing all my stories. Just having the boldness to move so far away from home. I had some family in Atlanta, but I wasn't really close to them. So I didn't spend time with them. I had good girlfriends in Atlanta and other friends from college. So I was like hanging out. So yeah. I was having a good time, like socially. I would just be up that interstate on, you know, whatever my Friday was, my schedule was all over the place. And I'd just be up in Atlanta. Wild in ways that I wasn't, I was just making up for lost time for college. I was very serious in college, and now I was just like, let me just go out to the club all the time.
That is the thing about you, is that you always have given off the very, I wouldn't even say serious, but very professional, very measured. It's that you're the type of person where when you said nobody would give you a shot or they kind of see you, it's like, I can picture you being like the lead candidate whenever you walk in a room just because of how you are.
Never. Like, only one time have I had like multiple options.
Interesting.
Yeah, in terms of like applying for jobs. Like, I apply to all kind of jobs all over the place, and it's usually just one at a time. Like one offer at a time.
And that one at a time is certainly built into something that you were really able to turn into a true career. You start in Macon. Now, I know you eventually end up in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
But after Macon, where did you go first before Philly?
Well, I mean, after Macon, I ended up leaving Macon and going home. And this was 2008, so the whole, you know, the recession. And then I was home for 9 months, and then I went to Charlotte. Well, basically with Macon, they wanted to re-sign me for another contract. I was like, there is no way. So I called my dad. Because they were like, we will give you $19,000 instead of $18,000. And so I called my dad first, because I knew my mom would freak out. So I called my dad. I was like, Dad, I don't want to do this. And he was like, well, you know, you should kind of stay with it, whatever. I was like, Dad, they're saying they'll give me $19,000 and I'm making $18,000. He goes, oh, they don't want you. Pack up your stuff and come home.
It's time to go.
So the trajectory was Macon, home for a minute, Charlotte, Nashville, Philly, and then New York.
That's a nice climb once you go Charlotte, Nashville, which is those two are about same level markets, mm-hmm. and then you get to Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. What was the experience like going to Philly? Because you grew up obviously not that far away from Philly. You were in Maryland and mm-hmm. everything. What was the Philly experience like for you?
Philly was also very different because it's nothing like Maryland at all. Maryland, I say, is the best of the North and the South. So it has Southern sensibilities. I know people call it the South, Mason-Dixon line. I'm aware we're not Southern, we're Mid-Atlantic. But just to get that out of there.
I got family in the South, trust me. Maryland ain't South.
It's not South. It's not South. But Philly was just different because it was so much more insular. And so being an outsider, they're very much like letting you know that you're an outsider. So I had to get people to vouch for me. Just to have people do stories with me and trust me. But Philly is where I became a journalist, really. Like, I learned how to write in, you know, Macon made me self-sufficient and gave me some confidence. Like, I can actually do this. And Charlotte taught me how to, like, cultivate a beat because I was covering education. So I was like, that's the first time I really delved into a topic. Nashville taught me how to write because I was working with like the best photographers in the country. Philly taught me how to be a dogged journalist. because it was so fast and a lot of the stories were national stories. It's faster than New York. The stories are harder than New York. So yeah, and just that, you know, you have to win the trust of people. You earn, like, if Philly loves you, you have earned every ounce of that.
That is a phrase. It's a phrase that when things went down the way they did with me at the previous job, there was a lot of righteous indignation when I was let go. Like, I was stunned at the amount that people actually were like there, because they're like, how can you let him go? He's fantastic. We love that guy. So, like, that was their whole thing. And I realized that it was like, if Philly doesn't like you, you'll hear it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When they love you, you'll feel it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the same thing you're saying right there. Like, yeah. Once you got in there and you knew that this, when the city actually has your back, yeah. It's a whole different world being in Philadelphia.
Different. And they are just great because they're not fake. There's not like a fake bone in their body. So like Philadelphians are different. They're just really different. And I think you have to like understand them. But yeah, once they like you for life. Like it's they'll stand by you. You could have a moment of being trifling and they will still be like, all right, but they're not going to abandon you.
No, Philly will have your back. And you were there. Well, all it's because that's where I met you, was in Philadelphia. Yeah. And you were one of the nicest people to me.
Well, thank
and I
you.
Still appreciate that, because I'm one of those people. I remember how people treat me, too. And if you treat me well, you're not getting rid of me, because I'm going to be one of those people who's always going to try to give that back to the way people treat me. And I remember when you leave Philly to come up here to New York City.
Yeah.
While it was our loss, that is a major deal. Coming to New York City, just like everybody who comes into this business, you look at one of the big three markets, New York, LA, Chicago. It's right. Always those three. I didn't realize that Philly was number four time,
but it's very big.
But it's New York, LA, Chicago, and you got to New York.
Yeah.
You mentioned that that Philly actually moves faster.
Yeah.
What was some of the other differences between being down Philadelphia and then coming up here to New York City?
I mean, just like certain things in terms of storytelling, like the government is set up a little bit different and just trying to navigate like who to call for different things. They call them different things here. It was just so big. It's really, really like ethnically diverse. So you can go in neighborhoods that are all Russian, or you can go to neighborhoods that are Hasidic, and you can go, you know what I mean? You just go down the street and it's Indian. And it's just so, I love that about it. So yeah, it is a bigger market because it's just all kinds of people here. But I mean, I felt more than prepared. I felt more than prepared to be here, because I still think Philly is a harder city to, like, I feel like it's harder to be a reporter. Not harder, but I think that like Philly just prepares you. It moves faster. The demands are so much more in Philly than they are here. So here I was like, that's it. That's all you want me to do. Like, you know what I mean?
That's like, all you need for me.
I was like, all right. Like, or even like the types of stories we would cover here in New York would be readers in Philly, because so much more news is what's happening in Philly.
It is. I can vouch for that, especially lately in Philadelphia, where as I'm talking to you, there's been a fugitive on the run for the last 12 days. So it's like, and that's one of about 15 different things in terms of news. And then you start tossing in feature stories, and it's headed to that time of the year where the Eagles and the Phillies, it's like there's never a dull moment in this business.
Not a dull moment at all.
You've obviously covered a lot. You've seen a lot just in this time period. I can't tell obviously that you've been doing this as long as you have, because I think thankfully we don't age. We're like the embodiment of black don't crack around here. But I always wonder, everybody has one of those stories or a couple of those stories that stick with them. Mm-hmm. What is a story that, whether it was in Philly or Macon or Charlotte or Nashville or here, that like maybe stuck with you in either good or bad way, either way?
There are two stories in Philly in particular. One was, we were in the Badlands, and that's what it's called, right? The Badlands, right?
Yeah.
I was just like, it's been so long, but like we were in the Badlands. It was like my first time in the Badlands, and I can't even remember if this, like, it was a laundromat / convenience store was like robbed or something. The owner or the man behind the desk, when the guy had stolen money or whatever, and the guy behind the desk came out when the guy was running away, shot him. The guy with the money, like, threw the money up in the air. Okay, so that's all we know. Like, the guy shot him, whatever. Like, will this, you know, he's, like, protecting his property, whatever. Will the police charge him? We're doing the interview. And while we're doing the interview with, like, a neighboring business or somebody on the street, I can't even remember who this guy was. And he said something, like, about shootings in this, you know, in this community, blah, blah, blah. And there's a pop. There are two pops. And he's like this one, and then kept talking. And so I'm not even, like, paying a whole lot of attention. And then I see my photographer, because he's behind me shooting, get into my line of sight. And he's, like, pointing because the cops had started running. So there was another shooting around the corner, and the cops were investigating this shooting. And then they start running to this other sound of gunshots, like, literally just around the corner. So then there's that, which you're like, this is wild. We finally see the video of this initial incident where the robber, whatever, throws the money up in the air. And these neighbors who we had talked to came out on the street and took the money. Stole this poor man's money.
He's losing that money one way or the other.
You know, but we had talked to him beforehand. They're like, ooh, this is awful that it happened to him. He's a good person. Da, da, da. But then we finally see the video, and they had I was like, that's the girl we had just talked to. Taking the man's money on the street. So that was just, like, a wild day of, like, you can't even make this stuff up. The other one was, we went to, this kid got shot, which was, like, so many of his stories that we covered in Philly. And this time, this is kind of, you know, it's kind of, sometimes I say things, like, just matter-of-factly, because it's just kind of...
We're used to, basically.
Right, but I have to realize that, like, other people don't experience life in this way. But the body was still there. The body's usually not there, because they do the scoop and take, you know. So in Philly, they basically, the police transport people, like, shooting victims to the hospital more than the ambulances do, because the police get there faster. So usually when you're going to a crime scene, the body's not there. This time the body was there. It was clear that the kid, and it was a kid, was dead. And so the body was still there. I mean, they had the sheet over him, but the body was still there. You know, so I was just like, when are they gonna pick him up? So then, you know, the police had the little perimeter. It was outside of a store. And you know, you go and super, super tense, because it's like the reality of the situation. It's always bad at the crime scenes or whatever, but it's really bad when the reality of the situation is right there in front of your face, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And so we're having to be very careful, because, you know, when people are filled with emotions, you just don't know how that's going to show up, right? And then we have a big old camera. You know, we can't be asking people, like, how do you feel? You have to, like, I have to go through the crowd a little bit, pull people out, see who's, like, emotionally okay to talk to us and not angry. But the child's father came and was screaming. And it was just, like, the most visceral, like, just the most visceral reaction. His son is just a few feet away from him, dead, and he's trying to figure out who did it, and he is just screaming, and it was just awful. It was awful. And then after, so we go, we get, you know, video, we do the interviews, we leave the neighborhood, go get something to eat real quick, only to get a call that around the corner somebody else had got shot in retaliation. So,
oh yeah, and see, that's as I'm hearing this, because one of the first during the first couple of weeks or maybe 3 weeks since I started in TV, I encountered a similar scene early in the mm-hmm. morning where I was originally supposed to be in house in studio, and the next thing you know, like, nope, you got to get out there, got a double murder. I get there just after the bodies have been pulled. but it's kind of the same, that weird, surreal feeling, because the old newspaper guy in me kicks in. I start walking up the street and taking mental notes and marking down what I see just so I can add color to the story. And you know where it happened. You look right down middle of the block. There's eight people standing on a porch and they're all looking down, and there's a fire truck in the middle of the street hosing down the spot where the bodies were. Yeah, and it just hit. It gets to you. It was tough for me. And as I'm doing the live hit, one of my first live hits, and I'm kind of laying it out, I'm wrapping up, about to toss back to studio. And I think it was, the victims were a husband and wife. The husband's sister starts screaming. Now, we're parked down the street. We're not in front of the house. We're down the street. But she's screaming at 7:05 in the morning. And you can hear it echoing up the street to the point where you can hear it on TV. My instinct as a radio guy is to lay out for a second, and you can kind of hear it without me having to say it. And I kind of laid out as like, it's a very difficult scene. Then the screams hit, and then I toss back to the studio. I'm thinking, how am I going to get through this? Because it's messing with my head. And I have two more. I had to do another live hit at 7:35, next one at 8:05, and then we were getting out of there, thankfully. But how is it that you can do these things? And I know people ask me this a lot, too. How can you cover scenes like that? And how much of that do you take home with you?
All of it. I took home all of it. It was not good. It wasn't good. Because, you know, it comes to a point where, like, your work cell phone, it had all these pictures, and it was like, everyone's dead, you know, because of the pictures that you've gotten from family, So you, like, go through, and it's like, oh, all these people have passed away, you know? And you never forget, like, especially, like, seeing that father. That was something that was more unique in terms of that visceral reaction from a father, and witnessing that. But a lot of times, like, it was like the moms who would agree to talk, not the dads so much would agree to talk to us. It was oftentimes the moms, and a lot of the moms were my age, you know? And so a lot of the questions for me is how am I having such a different human experience than them? You know, like, what is it with our society and our system to where, you know, certain communities are experiencing this disproportionately? Like, who can change this? Like, those are the questions I have, because that gives me a sense of responsibility of who I need to ask and who I need to, you know, hold accountable. You know, I never wanted to just go to the scene just to report on this thing. Like, I need to put some context around it. And what's hard in the industry, when things start going faster and faster and faster, and you have this hit and this hit and this hit and this hit, it doesn't allow for context. So you're just talking about what's happening in this moment in time and this moment in time, and the viewers or the listeners or the reader, whoever is consuming this, right? Like, they're taking it as an isolated, singular thing. But no, this is part of a bigger ecosystem and a failure of systems, right? And I just was disappointed that I never really had the space or time to really delve into that, because I just felt like I was doing a disservice by just talking about each individual incident singularly. And we had to have a broader conversation.
It starts to just rack up and they start to become faceless. You almost feel like they're just random statistics, but imagine that it's not. These are some of them are teenagers, their mothers, their fathers, their brothers. Young kids are always the ones that will always kind of mess with me. And obviously go to the true elephant in the room. We're both black. And so much, especially what you see in a city like Philadelphia. People who look like us.
100%.
And that's another thing I know that at times would linger with me. Because I'm an emotional individual anyway. It hangs with me. It messes with my head. Even when I was in radio and I wasn't in the street and I'm anchoring. And you're getting hit with one story after another. And it's just, it's like a ton of bricks on your shoulder sometimes.
I would go home and I would kind of sit there in silence a lot. And then I turn on Bravo a lot. Bravo was like my solace a lot of nights, because I worked night shift in Philly. And sometimes it just got so bad where, like, towards the end, it just got so bad that I would just like plead and be like, please don't send me to another shooting. Like, please, like, I don't, because it's not just going to the shooting. It's like, do you know where their family is? Go find family. And it's just like, it's going to find the family that kills me every single time. And, you know, just with the photographers, that's why that relationship is always so strong, because we would have to take a moment and we'd have a game plan, like, all right. And sometimes, you know, we're both kind of like, man, we don't want to come in. We just take a moment and be like, okay, you ready? All right. You ready? All right. Let's go.
And you got to just go.
And
you got to go in.
You just got to go in, because you don't know what's going to meet you on the other side. And everybody's entitled to everything. Some people are like, you're intruding on, like, it's the worst day of their lives, right? And they haven't even had a time, like, a chance to process the information. You know, I've had moms talk about their sons in present tense, because he had only been dead for a little bit. You know, like, it. And I've had moms where you talk to them and you're like, it hasn't even hit her yet. She's not even close to processing it. I've talked to a mom before who was drunk.
And what can you do?
Because why not? Because it is the worst day of your life and you are just trying to get through it. You know? And so in that one time, like with a mom, she just was, and then once I realized it, I like kind of gently cut the interview off, because I don't want her to be out there like that.
You want to make sure that you remember that these people are still human beings,
yeah,
going through the worst possible, yeah, moments. It's the thought of it, like, just thinking to the afternoons that I've had to deal with similar scenes, yeah, where I approach very slowly. I don't rush in there, because I've seen it with radio guys, especially with newspaper guys and even certain TV reporters. They dive right in. And it's one thing if you're dealing with a corrupt politician. Yeah, I'm going headlong in there,
right,
too. I'm
hitting
with every question.
Right.
They just lost their dad or their mom, or they lost their son or their daughter to something senseless. You got to tread lightly on these things, because aside from just the fact that these are human beings, that's how you're going to get them to talk to you, is if you treat them like people.
Yeah. And that sometimes is lost in with the people who don't have to do this, you know, to where it's a slug on a, you know, a rundown, and it's not fully real life to them, because they don't have to confront it face to face. That's something where, like, oh, well, such and such talks to the newspaper, where the newspaper is coming in as a singular person with their phone. And it's a very different situation when you come with a big old camera,
yep,
and you put it in someone's face and you say, I would try to, like, a lot of times, especially in Philly being black and, you know, not all of my photographers being black.
Right.
I would just go in by myself. I'd have my badge on and I'd go in. So I'd introduce myself and I'd have him hang. I was like, hang back. I just always, and Philly gave me spidey senses too. So I just have spidey senses about how you go into certain places and you're like, all right, I'm going to be okay here. You know, and sometimes, like, with, especially being a woman, you know, the photographers are like, you sure you don't want me to come? You sure you don't want me to come? And I was like, I'm okay. You know, like,
right.
I just have my spidey senses of, like, I'm okay here. Like, it'll be fine. And, you know, you try to get a family member to be your ally and kind of run interference for you. Sometimes it's just like, hey, you know, this is what, can you ask such and such, you know, to see if they want to. And I just always said, and I meant it, that, like, hey, we're doing a story about this and I hate to be here. And I think it's only fair to let you know. I would like to hear whatever you have to say about the circumstance, because we need to accurately reflect your loved one.
And kind of tell your son's story,
and
or your husband's
story,
or your daughter's,
and, like,
story.
Give, basically giving you the power back. Because when I was in Nashville, actually, I did a, this is random, it'll come full circle, but I did a breakfast. I hosted this breakfast for, like, the Deltas had a breakfast. They had me come and host it. And a woman whose son died in, I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. But she just said, nobody asked me. Everybody reported on it, but nobody asked me what my thoughts were. She was like, I would have told him that he was an honor roll student in the third grade, that I loved his little fat rolls when he was a baby, or that I, you know, like, he excelled at this other thing. I would have told them, but nobody asked me. Everybody created a narrative about my child with nobody asking for my input. And that was so poignant to me. And I was like, I will never be that person to not try to get the family, not in an exploitative way, but in a way to like give them their power back and saying, hey, I'm giving you an opportunity to participate in this. And for like, we're going to report on it tonight. So if there's a picture that you prefer, that you love, if there is a, you know, what, is there anything you want me to relay? Like, is there, can you talk to me on camera? All of those things.
It's the type of thing that I don't think, as I've taught before, it's the thing that I've told students, is to take that kind of approach to it. Talk to them the way you would want someone to talk to you, or to your sister, or to your brother, to your dad. Because if you approach them like human beings, it gets you everything you want.
Yeah.
And you're not exploiting them. You're just saying, look, let me tell, I want to be able to tell his story the right way.
Right.
Or her story the right way.
Right. And you know, some of the situations that folks have gotten, you know, that are in, is complicated.
Yeah.
Like, people have complicated lives, and I'm not here to judge or whatever. I'm just here to lay out, here are the circumstances. Philly was hard in that way emotionally, to digest all of that, because it was every week, all the time, multiple times a week, every single week, all the time.
I remember when you were down there, and it was some rough days. Mm-hmm. It was rough because of just the volume, more than anything else. You go from Philly to New York.
Yeah.
And then you reached a certain point where it feels like there was a pivot. There was a move to what you're doing now. Mm-hmm. Was there a particular moment where it was just like, I got to do something else, or I want to do something else, or you're just kind of thinking of what's next for me type of deal?
I've been thinking about that since I was in Nashville. Nashville was amazing and fantastic. And I just was like, you know, when I look at what my values are being, I'm very close to my family, being able to make comfortable money, especially that reflects all the sacrifices that I've made, right? Being able to travel, like take time off and travel, that's like a love of mine. I just hold those close, and I always have to remind myself, because everything in news tells you just to keep going, just to go to a bigger place, a bigger market, do the bigger things. And for a long time, I never checked in with myself. I do believe that you have to find a core competency. So I spent the first, I mean, I'm constantly learning, right? I was learning in New York City, but I think you got to get good at something. You got to be like actually good at it. So once I got to a point where I can do this, and I can do this at a high level consistently. And then so then I was like, okay, like I need to build other core competencies too. What else can I do? Like, what else can this look like? So from when I was in Nashville, I would go to the Entrepreneurship Center before my shift in the morning. They would have like coffee sessions and just listen to entrepreneur stories about how they came up with. I had no idea. I had no idea like what it could look like for me. I just was like so drawn to entrepreneurship. I was just like, I would pray sometimes, Lord, give me a product idea, you know, and I will pursue that. It's not that I didn't love journalism, but I always knew that there was going to be an expiration date, and I knew it was either going to be on my timeline or it was going to be forced, you know, and I just didn't want to be flat-footed either way.
That's one of the things about having a job like what we do as members of media. It's not as easy as you think it is. It's not that we just show up, put a camera in people's faces, and just leave it right there, and we have no emotional connection. As you heard from Andrea, it gets very emotional very fast in this line of work. Now, coming up after this break, we get to talk more about what she's doing now. Her next act, you see what I did there with the ACT, you see what I did? Her next act, and of course, her next best thing, as she now navigates through a world that isn't structured by news. This is the 119th episode of The People's Podcast. This is J. Scott Confidential, better known as JSC Radio, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to The People's Podcast.
The king is back, baby.
This is JSC Radio.
People are always looking to invest in a good opportunity. So what if you could invest in the future of kids, like a stock? Not the kind of stock that's about making money, but a stock for social change called Better Futures. With your investment, It helps students like me go to college. My name is Charles, and I'm your dividend.
Invest in better futures with UNCF. Visit uncf.org/invest. A mind is a terrible thing to waste, but a wonderful thing to invest in. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
You're listening to the People's Podcast. This is JSC Radio.
This is the 119th episode of the People's Podcast. This is J. Scott Confidential, better known as JSC Radio. Now, reminder once again, of course, you can check us out on all your favorite podcast providers. No matter where you're listening to us right now, you can hear us someplace else. If you're on Apple Podcasts, we're also on Spotify. If you're listening on Spotify, but you got the iHeartRadio app, guess what? You can find us there too. If you like Pandora, guess what? We're on Pandora as well. If you're looking at us, it may be on the Odyssey app, for example. Yes, we are there too. Wherever you got podcasts, pretty good chance if you throw in J. Scott Confidential, you're going to find that legendary logo, and here we are. And also want to speak, make sure we shout out everybody over at Rolly. I normally don't do things like this, but I feel compelled to do this because as a member of the media, so often we're trying to find experts that can speak to certain stories that we cover. And the Rolly app is a brand new app built by journalists for journalists to be able to help us find that expert, no matter what it is you're looking for. If you're covering a story on the economy and you need an economic expert, Rolly's got that for you. If you're looking for some expert on, say, concussions, we're in the middle of football season, guess what? We can find you a concussion expert over at Rolly. Make sure you go to the Rolly app to simply download it, right, whatever your app store is. Find it on the Rolly app. And when you look in the description of this particular podcast, especially if you're a journalist, this is for journalists by journalists. If you're a journalist checking this out, there's a link in the description that'll get you set up for a free account on Rolly. So make sure you support the Rolly app because they support journalists like me. And our guest this week, Andrea Klein Thomas, will pick up that conversation that we had last week in New York City, talking about what her next best thing is. This is episode 119 of the People's Podcast. This is J. Scott Confidential, better known as JSC Radio. Now back to our conversation with the amazing Andrea Klein Thomas.
You're listening to the People's Podcast. This is JSC Radio.
You found your way into this wonderful podcast space. You do.
Yeah, I'm doing this podcast now. It's fun.
It is fun. It's the
audio is fun.
I've been trying to tell people forever that this audio.
I'm late to the game, but audio is really fun.
It's so much more freewheeling.
It really is.
I say it to my students is that I know it may not seem like it. You want to do a little bit of radio before you step in front of that camera. It's like it unlocks something in there. I'm fine. I found out after 18 years of writing and audio that when you get in front of a camera all that time on radio, it doesn't hurt. And you're.
Yeah. I think audio really also helps you if you're shy to help you build confidence before they put a big old camera in your face. So I did it backwards. I did it the other way. I just was like stopped breathing in front of the camera. Making Georgia was a hot mess. But, you know, I had to fail publicly many times over and over again. I am in this podcast space right now. But just because there's also a low barrier to entry in audio, right? So you just need a little bit of equipment, not much, and you can like make it happen. And I already knew how to edit. Like I hadn't edited in a long time. I had to dust off some skills. but figured out how to edit and, loved interviewing. I had to think about like, what do I love the most about journalism? And it's about talking to people and like,
it's those conversations.
It's those conversations are everything. Every time I like record another interview, it is literally the best day of the week.
It sounds like from what I've seen, obviously, and because I've seen them and heard them, it's the next big thing. Mm-hmm. And for you, that has been this podcast space, but there's more to it. And I've checked out your website and kind of give some people some insight in what the next big thing is for you, Andrea.
Well, I'm still like figuring it out. And it's just really like assessing what my skills are, right? And then building on that. So, you know, I'm a forever journalist is what I will always be telling stories. And now I can just do it across various mediums. I'm not just relegated to local news. So the podcast, The Next Best Thing, that is telling stories about career and life transitions, how people navigate it, especially people of color. I just felt like there was a void in that space. And those are the conversations I was having with my friends. So that's storytelling, like career and life transitions on audio. I have clients where, like I'm working with The Atlantic right now, and this is like my third contract with them. They have the Atlantic Festival, which is their journalism live, like their live journalism event. And so I curate panels. I curate panels for them for their festival forums. And so that is like doing a story. It is coming up with an idea, like an editorial meeting, right? And then so the underwriters determine what they want to talk about. And then I have to go do research and figure out the angles and then figure out who to talk to. That's what I did every single day.
Pretty much. News,
you know, and making sure that I have diverse voices, that I'm bringing them to the table. And then I'm like prepping moderators and stuff like that for what questions to ask during the interview. All things that I've, you know what I mean? That's like my day. I've produced a show as a senior producer of the show on cable, legal affairs show. So it's, again, it's everything that I did. I just have a formal title. I had a formal title and I was managing a small team. But from conception of the idea to the editing, all the back end and giving notes for the editors and how to clean certain things up and audio and all, like, that's everything that I was doing. So basically I have agency now to take all of my skills and apply it more broadly. And learn a lot of things in the process.
You've told me about some of the really good things. What's maybe been the biggest challenge in all of this for you? Because it feels like while a lot of this is seamless, the people on the outside, they think, oh, it's just a seamless transition. There's more to it than that.
It's not a seamless. Well, it is and it isn't a seamless transition. I mean, I, again, have been preparing for this for a really, really long time. So I have been stepping out of my comfort zone to do a lot of different things for like 8-9 years in small things in preparation for the big thing, right? And so this past year, I left in January of 2022. The whole first year, everything that I got from friends, you know, based on relationships, good money, good money. So it's great. So it like kept me afloat. I didn't have to worry, like, cause that's my Achilles heel. Like, how am I going to pay for things? How am I going to pay for my lifestyle? And now I'm going out to pitch, cold pitch. And so it's really trying to find the words to really explain what it is I do and how I can add value. A bit of a challenge. It's getting into the business space. Like, journalists are not good in business. Like, in terms of, like, we don't have the exposure to business that we think we do.
Right.
You know, it's like, I think, you know, I would always say, I know a little bit about a lot of different things, blah, 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 and we critique systems and stuff like that as part of the job, but we actually have no idea how business functions and runs and all the systems that are in place to make it go. And so, this has been a challenge in that, and the amount of stuff that I've learned in the last year is like my head explodes, like crazy.
As a Black woman in this space, what has this experience been like for you?
You know, that's so interesting. Well, it's freeing, right? Like, I'm free. I'm free. I'm free to do. I believe in myself. I always have. I have like a quiet confidence. But I don't have to. I just believe that I can make everything happen for myself,
which is absolutely incredible. What advice would you give to young woman, young man who's maybe been in this industry about the same amount of time that we have, and they're kind of on that verge of, do I still want to do it? It's like, and you want to make that pivot. What is the pivot point, or what would you suggest that they do if they actually do want to make the leap out of the daily grind of being in front of the camera, in front of a microphone, to doing something more like what you're doing here?
Well, the thing is that there's so many options. And I think that, like for local news in particular, it was so insular and made you think that this was the be all end all. And the only other thing that you could do was go to network when, or if you get out, all you do is, not all you do, people love this, I happen to not, PR, or you could be a college professor. Like when I started, that's what everybody who got out was in PR, or they were a college professor, or both. That was it. Now, storytelling is democratized, and and it is, in fact, a skill. And a lot of things that I think that the business might not give you props for because it is such a prerequisite to do your job outside is not, you know, does not come easily to other people. Being able to speak in public does not come easy to people. Being able to write and articulate your feelings does not come easy to other people. Being able to make a stranger feel comfortable and getting to know them, interviewing them, does not come naturally to other people. So just understanding that, one, you have a lot of different options out there. You can get really creative. Two is that you have core competencies that are marketable out there in the marketplace. Three, and I think if this is the biggest thing and it's the hardest thing for people's proximity. Like, I came to New York City for a reason. I didn't come because I wanted to be here. I didn't come because I had dreams of the lights and what I thought I was going to be swallowed up alive. Like, I was like, I am too old for this. I should have done this when I was 22. Like, you know what I mean? I should have done this. Like,
I keep forgetting we're actually pretty close in age, too.
I should have done this when I was like right after college when my other girlfriends did it and, you know, lived in the, you know, place with four people. I should have done it then. I was like, I have creature comforts now and they're very expensive in New York City. Like, how are you going to come here as a grown up? But it's the proximity. It's the proximity to the possibility, right? And so that's why I'm still here, because everything that I'm doing now I could do at home in Maryland, and DC is not a small place either, but I would have, I have to put myself mentally in position and also physically in position to create something. Because what I'm creating is from my imagination. I don't necessarily see somebody, I'm not modeling myself after somebody, because the people who are doing what I really want to do are big time names and I don't have that cachet. So how am I going to leverage what I have and try to build something from scratch? And so that's like really, really hard to do, but I'm in the place where it can be done.
I always admire the person that you are even more so
than
the reporter, because we all go through this. We all kind of fight our way through this. And you were always someone that was good to me from day one. And I've always said, I always appreciate good people, because we need more people like you not just in doing what we do as a journalist, but just in general building on this. And I'm honestly, I think it's dope that you're doing what you're doing, because I kind of see as some inspiration of that, because I've been doing something similar even while in the midst of navigating through 18 years in radio now going into TV. But you said it, everything's got a shelf life. We got a shelf life, and we can't do this forever. And it's the same thing where I've had those moments too, where it's like, damn, I wish I did this when I was maybe 25 or 26 instead of just running around doing what I was doing. And it's,
yeah. But also, I think one last thing I would say is that you got to get to know the business. And that's something I always respected this. I always respected journalism as a business, and I paid attention to what was happening in the business. Right now, the advertising dollars are not coming in how they used to, and they never will ever again.
Nope.
Because of big tech. Right. And so you have to understand the business structure and not your feelings. Like, that was it for me, is that I saw the types of conversations that I was having. I saw that I was being asked to do a ton more. And the trade-off wasn't in my favor. Right. And it would be more high profile, but like, you can't go to your electric company with high profile. Like,
you can't pay rent with experience.
Yeah. That's not the transaction that we have in this country. I think that the writing is on the wall for a lot of people with technological advancements like AI. There is a whole, I say all that to say, yes, know the business, but also understand there's a whole digital economy out there.
Yep.
And that you have to, and what I've struggled through, I guess, is that everything that local news tells you to do is that the story's not about you. Don't build your personal brand. will not make you win out in the world, right? Like, you have to build your personal brand. You have to have some sort of niche or point of view, and that, you know, you can start building now before you even make the leap. I was building years before I pulled the trigger. I just knew I would pull the trigger at some point. I was going to ride this thing so the wheels fell off, but I knew I had to pull a trigger at some point. And I was building slowly, from expanding my network to doing more speaking engagements to get comfortable, to going to conferences that were different, to just going to meet more people, getting myself uncomfortable, going to just, I didn't know what I need to listen to when I went to the Entrepreneurship Center in Nashville, but just going to listen and see what I could learn, you know, stuff like that.
So how can people get in contact with you, and how can they actually find your podcast?
Yeah. So the next best thing is the podcast. It's all over the podcast platforms, all of them. Your favorite, just choose your favorite and put that in. It's me giving a peace sign, looking over my shoulder, giving a peace sign. And it's also on YouTube. YouTube's a little bit harder. You have to search for my company, Mountain Court Media.
And then I'll make sure that link is in the description of this podcast, by the way.
Yeah,
too.
I'll definitely send it to you. And then AndreaCT.com is my website. AUNDREACT.com. And yeah.
You got to make sure we spell it correctly. It is, yeah. It is Andrea.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much for this.
Thank you for being here. For coming all this way. That's so nice.
Coming up here. For you, I would make that trip up here. I dig New York City. I do.
It's so fun.
And getting up here to do this and having you on kind of the rebirth version of J. Scott Confidential. Yeah. It's been 3 years. And it's great to be able to start having conversations. Because I don't do interviews.
Yeah.
I have conversations with people.
That's the way
I've always approached it.
Yeah.
I love having conversations with people like you, where I find so much inspiration in what you've done. And I'll never forget how good you were to me at a time period when things were not the best for me.
So I
will do everything I can to support whatever you're doing.
We're all we got. Look, we got to support each other.
We have to. Well, we should. That's another conversation altogether. We should. And I know I definitely will. Andrea, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for being here.
And there you have it. That is our conversation with the incredible Andrea Klein Thomas. Of course, once again, you can find her at Andrea CT, that's Andrea spelled with a U, AUNDREACT. That's on Instagram. You can also, of course, find The Next Best Thing on The Next Best Thing ACT. And as she mentioned, that podcast can be found on all your favorite podcast providers. So make sure you drop a subscribe on that and check that out, because she's doing amazing work there, not just on her podcast, but with all the work she's doing outside of it. Before I go here, and I would be remiss if I didn't say something about this, Mel Tucker, the head football coach at my alma mater, Michigan State University. I'm not going to beat this up too long. I'm not going to take this too far. As I'm recording this, the university has announced their intention to fire Mel Tucker for cause after getting tied up in this awful sexual harassment situation. I'm addressing this not as J. Scott Smith, the journalist. I'm addressing this as, then get ready for me to use my shoot name for the first time on here. I'm addressing this as Jason Scott Smith, an alumnus of Michigan State University, a donor to Michigan State University, and a guy who simply loves Michigan State University. Mel Tucker got to go. We can't have this. Go back in the archives to 4 or 5 years ago when all the Larry Nassar stuff went down. And you got a very good understanding of what my thoughts were about situations like this. We as Spartans cannot have this. We as Michigan State alums cannot have this. We as a society can't have this. I don't want to hear, but he said it was consensual. If we've learned nothing else about how things go with relationships, especially in the last 15, 20 years, as people have finally kind of gotten on board with understanding that consent has to be mutual and consent can be revoked at any point in time. But let's get past that point for a second. If you've ever worked in a company or a business, you do understand that there are policies that say it doesn't matter if it's consensual or not, you can't have relationships
like that in office. And for those of you who say, well, she's not a university employee. She was just somebody who came to speak at the school. Yes, and this is an understanding of business that a lot of you don't seem to get. Just because you're not an employee, if you get paid by the university, which she was, you are considered a contractor or a vendor. You can't do those sort of things with interns, for example. And in a lot of cases, you can't even do them with students. So even if she's listed as not being an employee, guess what, bucko? You can't do it. Mel Tucker is done. Done. And it's a fall from grace that has come as quickly and as stunningly as any I've ever seen. It wasn't 2 years ago that that guy was probably number two to Tom Izzo at Michigan State University in terms of popularity. That team was 11-2. They had a revelation of a season 1 year after COVID, and it looked like you had the rare instance of somebody being the man who follows the man where they make it work. I've long said you never want to be the man that follows the man. The previous man was Mark D'Antonio, and those are going to be some big shoes to fill. Even if the end of D'Antonio's tenure at Michigan State didn't go well, he's a giant there. He's a legend there. He's arguably one of the three best coaches in the football program's history, and he might not be number three. Only because Duffy Doherty won multiple national championships do I not put Mark D'Antonio at number one. So to be the guy that follows that guy, you have to be pretty much, you got to be ready to bring it or it's not going to go well for you. And after a 2020 where nobody really benefited from that year, nobody wanted to count that, they go 11-2. They're still, to date, the last Big Ten team to beat Michigan. They have that great season. They have that terrible game at Purdue that they shouldn't have lost, and then they went and got blasted out of Columbus. But they're 11-2. They win the Peach Bowl. They look like Mel Tucker was going to pick things up and keep the train moving, keep the party going. And then they go 5-7. And he gets signed. By the way, prior to that season, he gets signed during the 11-2 year to an insane deal, the type of deal that nobody would have turned down. 10 years, $90 million. Just an insane amount of money. Like 95, I think it was a word that was like 95 million, whatever it is, it's an insane amount of money for a coach of a program off of one great season. And those of you who have understood contracts, like I've grown to understand contracts the last couple of years, you got to read the fine print in them. And one of the bits of that fine print of that contract, because guess what? He could have gone winless the last 2 years. They went 5-7 last year, so yeah. But they could have gone winless the next 2 years. If they fired him, they would have had to pay him every single penny. Between Matt Ishbia throwing $25 million and the university throwing in $71 million, they would have had to pay him that money regardless. The only way he doesn't get paid is if he gets arrested or if he does something to bring shame upon the university. Even if he just got fired for being bad at his job, if he went out there and was just bad at his job for 2 or 3 years, he was going to take home a legendary bag and he would never have to work again. And instead, he did this. I don't care if it was supposedly consensual or not. I've long learned if a woman insists that something wasn't consensual, I'm going to side with her before I side with a dude insisting that it was. Especially when, as the facts begin to trickle out, it looks like he's not exactly very fond with the truth. Mel Tucker's done at Michigan State University, and the shame of my alma mater continues. And I would have been remiss, considering how we handled Larry Nassar a few years ago, I would have been remiss if I didn't say just anything about this here. We got to do better, gentlemen. We got to do better. Quit making excuses for nonsense like this. Quit making excuses for behavior like this, especially in professional settings. I wish somebody would pay me a tenth of what they paid Mel Tucker. You wouldn't see me anywhere. I would shut down social media. I would go to the office, then turn around and go back to the crib. Because I know even if I go winless, I'm getting paid that much money? Oh no, I'm keeping my nose clean. I'm not going to be doing stupid things like this, not only risking my professional life, but my personal life. Are you kidding me? This is not how this works, bro. We can't do this, and we won't do this. And I'm not going to be sitting here making any excuses for Mel Tucker. I just hope my university finally gets itself extricated from this mess. With that, we're wrapping it up. My name's Jay Scott Smith, telling you to take care of yourself. God bless. Always dare to be different. And in honor of the legend that we lost this past month, Bob Barker, always have your pet spayed or neutered. Remember to adopt and not shop. And we are out of here. Be checking out the feed here and be on the lookout for episode 120 coming up sometime in the month of October. But until then, goodbye, everybody.
You're listening to the People's Podcast.
So put down your pipe and smoke it.
This is JSC Radio.
I heard on the news about that 5-year-old who found his uncle's gun. The kid didn't know it was loaded.
I heard on the news about that 14-year-old girl who was bullied online for like a year. She couldn't take it anymore, so she got her dad's gun from his nightstand.
I heard on the news about that guy who broke into someone's house, stole a gun from the hall closet.
He accidentally shot his cousin in the head.
She killed herself.
And later, killed the owner of the store he was trying to rob.
If you own a gun, you have a full-time responsibility. When you aren't using it, be sure it can't get into the hands of curious children, troubled teenagers, a thief, or anyone else who might misuse it. Your family, friends, and neighbors are all counting on you. Remember, always lock it up. For more information on firearm storage safety, visit ncpc.org. This message brought to you by the National Crime Prevention Council, the Bureau of Justice Assistance, and the Ad Council.